Outrage mounts over the Trump administration's zero-tolerance border policy of separating young children from their parents. Could the after-effects be felt all the way to the midterm elections? A closer look just ahead. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9, and thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live on the radio at 9. Also, make sure to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Just ahead, a look at the myths and the facts around what's happening at the border and what's happening in Florida as we take your calls at 549-2937. Then later, why a recent study says sea level rise will eventually swamp millions of coastal homes, including here in Florida. Plus, he turns 100 years old tomorrow, and he has a story everyone in Jacksonville needs to hear. We'll speak with local legend, veteran, and activist Solly Mitchell. All of that ahead this morning. But first, this hour, outrage grows over the Trump administration's decision, which started just in April, to separate children, no matter their age, from their parents when they try to illegally cross the southern border. ProPublica has published heartbreaking audio of children at a U.S. Customs and Border Protection facility who have been separated from their parents. In this audio, which is difficult to listen to, you can hear children crying and asking for their parents. One child is heard begging for someone to call her aunt, saying she even has the phone number memorized. Take a listen. Now, the president and top administration officials say U.S. laws or court rulings are forcing them to separate families who are caught illegally trying to cross the border. By the way, that's a misdemeanor. That claim by the president and his top officials is false. Immigrant families are being separated primarily because the Trump administration in April of this year began to prosecute as many border crossing offenses as possible. This zero tolerance policy now applies to all adults, regardless of whether they cross alone or with their children. The policy to separate young children from their parents, which is now defined by the American Academy of Pediatrics, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and the United Nations High Commissioner on Human Rights, as child abuse, has drawn widespread and bipartisan condemnation. All four living former first ladies have condemned this policy, including Laura Bush, who this week penned a rare op-ed article calling for the policy to stop immediately. This outrage is not just happening on the southwest border. Today, Senator Bill Nelson is expected to visit a detention center in Homestead, Florida, where hundreds of children have been housed. We are attempting to learn if some of those children are part of this new policy to separate children from their parents and if they've been moved from the southwest border to a facility in Homestead. What are the moral and also the political implications for this controversial policy? This morning, we're pleased to welcome Stephanie Mickle and Katie Ross, both with the D.C.-based Mickle Public Affairs, a firm focused on electing women, among other things. Stephanie Mickle, on the line from Washington, thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
And Katie Ross, here in Studio 5. We appreciate you being here as well.
Thanks for having me, Melissa.
And Stephanie Mickle, in a minute, we'll get to some other news and notes about what you're working on. But first, I want to get your reaction as the female head of a public policy and public affairs firm. Many of the voices crying out about this policy are female voices, including former First Lady Laura Bush, as they see what's happening at the border. What are the politics of this policy and, frankly, this humanitarian crisis at the southern border as women, moderate women, independent women, women that have voted for both Republicans and Democrats, watch what's happening, frankly, in horror?
Well, Melissa, absolutely. As you note, obviously, I'm a woman, and so my heart goes out, as I'm sure many women's hearts go out, to these children and to what's happening with them. I mean, no woman wants to be separated from her child. And certainly this decision to do family separation is personally very difficult. And then I would just say from a policy standpoint, the country already has a very overtaxed immigration system. It's been, and it's flawed. It's not perfect. It's been overtaxed for years. There's been multiple efforts in the Congress to achieve some type of comprehensive immigration reform without success. But the problem with this issue is that it makes the children pawns in a political game that the administration will not win. They're not going to win this. Anytime you pit children, mothers and children, against a policy which seems so callous and so cold, ultimately, people are going to continue to get outraged, and that's what we're seeing.
And the number to join the show, 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. Lots of comments already on our Facebook page. Katie Ross, The Washington Post reported the other day that President Trump sees the policy as leverage to help him achieve his goals regarding immigration policy, including his border wall that thus far Congress is refusing to pay for. Using children, in effect, as political pawns, I think, is perhaps the most troublesome aspect of what we see happening at the border.
Absolutely, Melissa. Children are not a bargaining tool. They're not bargaining chips to get what you want in a policy arena, as Stephanie had mentioned earlier. I don't know how successful he's going to be with these methods. I think we've seen in terms of outrage on social media, and not just from women, but from men too, kind of expressing this outrage. But I think ultimately he will be unsuccessful.
And why do you say that?
Gosh, well, this is not a partisan issue. This is a human being issue. This is an American tragedy. And, you know, I feel that I don't think the American people will allow it to happen. I really don't. I feel like I have faith in the American people and the voter. And I think that folks will continue to reach out to their elected officials through the Justice Department and the White House. And I think if enough people do that, we will certainly see some movement in a positive direction.
Stephanie Mickle, you're focused on getting particularly women involved in the political process. But what we're seeing unfold across the country is outrage and horror from men and women of all backgrounds and political stripes. This is that rare issue, I think, where moral clarity is obvious. And it is not a difficult decision to come to, whatever your politics, that it is simply wrong to inflict this trauma on young children.
You know, Melissa, I'm not convinced that it's obvious. And the only reason I say that is that it should be, right? Absolutely. Something in your own internal compass should say this is wrong to separate children from their parents. However, as a political tool to achieve, you know, a policy outcome, but we see the administration, the Secretary Nielsen, Attorney General Sessions, the President, the Sarah Huckabee Sanders, all of these speakers on behalf of the Trump administration defending this policy. And there is, at a minimum, a school of thought that says, and we see this on social media as well, from more conservative outlets and other perspectives, that says, if you break the law, you should pay the consequences. You should come through the ports that are available for political asylum. It's your job to know where they are. I don't care if you're fleeing from, you know, drug lords or certain governments. It doesn't matter. You need to know where those ports are. You need to come through. You need to follow the law. You need to do things the right way. Otherwise, you have made the decision to have your children separated. And so there is a hardline philosophy that is being espoused by multiple leaders in the administration, as well as multiple people in the country who say, well, you know what? I agree. If you want to immigrate to the United States, do it the right way. And I'm not defending illegal immigration. Let me be very clear about that. What I'm simply saying is that compassion, there is a place for compassion. And this particular situation is forcing compassion to the forefront, because it is really making us take a look at how we want to be perceived in the world. And I want to pick up on something that Katie said, which is, as you mentioned in the outset, the United Nations, Human Rights Watch, several organizations have condemned the decision that was made by the Trump administration back in April to separate their children from their parents. And so the world is watching us. The world is seeing how we are choosing to handle this. And I don't believe that most Americans want to be perceived as that type of person.
Top Republicans, in fact, everyone from Ted Cruz to Mitt Romney, Jeb Bush, many others have called for an end to this policy and pleaded for a more humane and bipartisan solution to this issue of illegal immigration. Katie Ross, going beyond the moral questions, let's talk about the politics of this, particularly in Florida, where we sit today, which is a swing state. You and your colleague Stephanie Mikkel are focused on getting more women elected. How do the politics of this play out as we look ahead to the November midterms? Certainly right now, as Republicans are looking to hold Congress, and they want to tell a different narrative than the one that's playing out. They want to talk about tax cuts. They want to talk about a growing economy. Instead, the nation is being treated to these horrific images and this horrific audio of traumatized children at the southern border. How does this affect the balance of power in Washington and in Florida?
Melissa, absolutely. Republicans running for re-election and Republican congressional leadership want to get ahead of the midterms and frame the issue and focus on issues and bills that they're working on. And that's just not happening right now. The White House and Trump's zero-tolerance policy is framing the issue. Do I think it's going to affect the midterms? Absolutely. I don't think anyone can deny the emotional reaction a lot of voters, a lot of individuals have when listening to this recording and looking at some of these images. I think voters are definitely going to keep this will not go away. This is not going away. People are not going to get distracted by other issues. This is something that's going to outrage will stick around until the zero tolerance policy stops.
Let's go to your calls now. What are your thoughts and comments as we talk about what's happening at the southern border? By the way, hundreds of children are being detained at a center in Homestead, Florida as well. We are attempting to confirm if those children are younger than 10 and if they've been moved to Florida from the southwest border. Give us a call, 549-2937. Dave is in Nassau County right now. Hi, Dave. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call, and good morning. My point is that you neglected the fact that that polls are showing that that the majority of Republicans are in approval of this policy, whereas, you know, most Americans are against it. But the Republican Party has essentially become this cult of personality around Trump. It's no longer the Republican Party. It's the party of Trump. And as a result, just about anything that this guy does is accepted almost without hesitation from this following. And it's very disturbing to see that the Republican Party goes so far to this extreme. And I'll just take the response off the air. Thank you.
Dave, thanks for the call. Stephanie Mikkel.
Absolutely. And I appreciate you mentioning the cult of personality that is surrounding Trump, because, yes, the party of the Republican Party has moved away from, many of you, myself included, that has moved away from some of the more traditional Republican values and has moved into this more extreme perspective. And I do think it will have an impact on the midterms. I would just like to say that I think, you know, the polls that I'm seeing estimate that there may be a slight switch in the House. We may see the House turnover by maybe 20, 30 seats. But, you know, and that's to be expected when you have the House, the Senate, and the White House all in the same party. That's very typical. We saw it in 2010 when the Tea Party wave rolled in to Washington. But I would like to say this, that there is a very, I would agree with the caller, there is a very extreme perspective on what's appropriate and what's not in terms of the immigration policy and the child separation policy. But I do think that issue, as well as all the incessant scandals that we have been seeing almost on a weekly basis, will drive voters to the polls in November.
Lisa on the north side. Go ahead, Lisa.
Hi, y'all. This is Lisa King. I'm the daughter of an economic refugee who came to this country at age 5 with his younger sister and his mom. And I can't help but think, as a mother and a grandmother myself now, what this must be and what it would be for my family if this had happened to us. The consequences in terms of how these families at some point could be reunited and the trauma these children will endure during this period is just horrific. And I agree with your guests that this is not a partisan issue. However, I do lead the Duval Democrats, and I can tell you we are going to hold every Republican office holder accountable on their opinion on this tragedy.
And how do you plan to do that?
Well, asking them, holding them accountable, and making sure voters know.
All right. Thanks for that call. That's Lisa King from the local Democratic Party. Lots of calls coming in from across the listening area. Tracy is in Mandarin. Hello, Tracy.
Good morning. Good morning. You know, this is like torturing the children and torturing the parents, too. So many legal people, the lawyers, they do illegal things. Do you separate the families, the children? What is Supreme Court doing here? I think this is horrible, just absolutely horrible. Pediatric department, the head of the pediatric department should reach the Supreme Court. And this just, it's horrible separating, really. I thank you very much.
Right. Thank you, Tracy. And of course, the nation's physicians, the American Academy of Pediatrics have denounced this simply because of the extremely traumatic effects on young kids. All right, let's go to Sue in Green Cove Springs. Hi, Sue. Good morning.
Hi. I just want to say that a few weeks ago on the radio, it was saying that the people were being housed in prisons and therefore they had to separate the children who couldn't go there, which is very confusing. Then why not put these mothers and fathers that have children with them in a military base? Or in a church facility? Why do they have to put them exactly in a prison? That's all I had to say. I just can't believe somebody would do this. But I don't think it's all Trump. I think it's just a situation that needs to be resolved.
Thanks, Sue. Well, you know, this is a policy that only began in April. It's the president's policy along with his attorney general, Jeff Sessions. This is a policy change, and it's brand new and, frankly, has never been done before in this country. Katie, and thank you for the call, Sue. Katie Ross, the idea being that the president and his attorney general and also John Kelly, the president's chief of staff, General Kelly, have been hinting all throughout 2018 that they were considering this policy as a way to deter more illegal immigration, that if people from Central and South American countries knew that their children would be taken from them at the border, they might not come. And so this policy went into effect in April. Never before have people crossing the border been separated from their children in this manner. Critics of the status quo said that this situation of what's known as catch and release needs to end, whereby people coming in over the border with their children are apprehended, but then let go. And some of them were able to then slip into the country and immigration officials lost track of them. So we need to be clear about this. This is not the law. This is a policy change that is being used as a wedge to deter further illegal immigration. And in so doing is traumatizing thousands of children.
Absolutely. You know, this is an American tragedy. We've spoken several times about how it's been proven that trauma can affect a child's growth and development. And we're going to have to take responsibility for that as a country. The president can stop this at any time. Congress also has the power to stop this. The GOP controls both houses and the White House. So there's a capacity there to end this policy. I'd like to point that out.
Mel tweets the show, one thing the creators of this policy of separating immigrant children from their parents didn't take into consideration, the mothers of this nation are going to destroy them, she writes. On Facebook, we have a wealth of comments about this policy. Scott writes, whoever is at fault, whoever takes the blame, stop it. It is child abuse. Laura writes, it's inhumane, anti-American, and shameful. Paul, you need to mention that Clinton started this policy, that Bush and Obama kept it going. How about that Trump is trying to work with Congress to fix it? Stephanie Mickle, what about that?
Well, I'd love to respond to a couple of those things, excuse me. Yes, this did start under the Clinton administration because of a Supreme Court decision that happened in the 1990s. And so yes, this did start that way, but it was never enforced as 100% zero tolerance. Even under the Obama administration, You would have a couple of, I think there was an estimate of about 30 cases of this happening, but there was never zero tolerance in the way that we see it now. And yes, while the Congress could pass a law in theory about this particular issue, Congress has attempted to take up comprehensive immigration reform several times over the last 10, 15 years unsuccessfully. And this is the type of thing that does not require legislation. And I would just like to mention that this is a policy decision that the enforcement of which can be easily altered based on how the guidance is issued from the Department of Homeland Security and from the Department of Justice and from the White House. So legislation is not required. While sometimes, I will say this, sometimes the presidential administration would like to get congressional support or congressional rebuke of their policies because it gives them what we call in the business political cover. That is not required under this situation. And then lastly, I do want to go back to something one of your social media persons mentioned, which is they have completely underestimated the power of mothers, because you're right. The hand that rocks the cradle is the hand that rules the world. And we have seen so many movements that have started, Mothers Against Drunk Driving and others, because women have said, you know what, you're not going to treat children this way, or we need to do better about family issues or about children's issues. And this is absolutely clearly a family issue.
Clyde emails the show, I can't believe we are doing this to families, and it is all of us who are responsible. This is our country doing this. This horrible practice is perhaps more heartless and cruel than the Japanese internment, given the effects on children. Let's go to Rachel. She's along Bay Meadows. Hello, Rachel.
Hi there. Good morning. Yes, I just want to make the point that my understanding of international law is that it is entirely legal for a refugee to come to our border for assistance, and we should never be treating people in this manner.
Thanks, Rachel. Let's talk about that quickly, Katie Ross, and then we'll talk a little bit about Mikkel Public Affairs, which is what you had originally been booked to come on the show and talk about. Refugees seeking asylum are being told that if they don't go to designated ports of entry, that their children will be separated from them. It's my understanding that this is a new policy. Also, what a lot of Americans are just waking up to is that border crossings in the South are up because Central American countries are being roiled by drug and gang violence, and a lot of people are trying to escape that. That's my understanding on both of those points.
Yes, that's also my understanding.
Yeah. And so as we continue talking about this humanitarian crisis, we want to take a minute to talk about Stephanie Mikkel and Katie Ross of Mikkel Public Affairs. Of course, Katie, you've grown up here in Jacksonville. You've joined forces mm-hmm. with Stephanie, and particularly you're focused on electing women. Stephanie, you also have a memoir coming out. It's called Follow the Leader, and it's about women in politics.
Yes, absolutely. And Melissa, I'm from Gainesville, Florida, originally. Mm-hmm. So I don't have a Jacksonville connection per se, except friends and family. But I do feel like I'm not that far away in terms of my hometown roots. But yes, let's talk about our firm and as well as the book that's coming out. We have a political communications, political messaging, public affairs firm called Mikkel Public Affairs, and it grew out of my over 20 plus years of experience in politics, Katie's 15 years in politics, and just a desire to offer a different way of how do we approach electing women to office, as well as how do we make sure that women are involved in political conversations like the discussion that we're having today on immigration and others in a way that is complementary to the discussions that are already going on. Women offer a different perspective in terms of how we problem solve. We offer a different perspective in terms of our life experiences. And it's not, and in my view, it's not about replacing what men do. It's about complementing it so that we get, as a practical matter, get a better policy outcome for our families, for our communities, for our country. And so that's what we do and what we prioritize in terms of working with candidates, working with political action committees, working with trade associations, working with individuals who are looking to become more influential in a particular policy space. And then my book, Follow the Leader, which is coming out this summer, is about, it draws from my lifelong experiences of being involved in the political process, but it also encourages women to look for ways and people who have traditionally not been involved in politics at the same level, for example, people of color, millennials, and the like, to look for ways to engage. Not everyone has to run for office. Not everyone is suited to run for office. Not everyone desires to run for office. But everyone can get involved in the process, whether they're writing letters, whether they're writing checks, whether they're calling their representatives, their local officials, or whether they're running for office. And so that's what we want to accomplish with the book, is just to offer people real specific ways that they can plug in to the process so that we have ultimately a better political outcome in our country.
Well, thank you both for joining us on this very newsworthy week. Stephanie Mikkel, CEO, and Katie Ross, her colleague with Mikkel Public Affairs. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Much more still ahead later. Don't miss it as we speak to veteran, activist, and local legend Solly Mitchell, just ahead of his 100th birthday. But up next, the danger of sea level rise to Florida's housing market. We'll tell you about that right after this.
Community Hospice and Palliative Care. Since 1979, the compassionate guide for more than 200,000 patients facing advanced illness in Northeast Florida. Today, serving 16 counties, including yours. Available 24/7 to help you and your loved one. More at choosecommunityhospice.com.
Hello, I'm Doug Hansard, and I listen to the Florida Times Union On Demand as read by WJCT Radio Reading Service volunteers. The sound quality is excellent. This is a great asset for people like me, sightless and on the go. The Florida Times Union Daily on the radio reading website at wjct.org/radio reading. Take advantage of it, and while you're there, register as a listener.
WJCT and Baptist Health are pleased to announce that Bobby Thomas, beauty and fashion expert and author of The Power of Style, Everything You Need to Know Before You Get Dressed, will be this year's keynote speaker at A Day for Her, Saturday, August 18th at the Hyatt Hotel. Bobby, the style editor for The Today Show, will share Bobby's buzz tips on everything from favorite beauty tricks to her favorite lifestyle finds. For more information or to purchase tickets, log on to wjct.org/events.
I'm David Luckin, host of the Electro Lounge, inviting you to join me Tuesday nights at 9 for Turntable Tuesday, only at the Electro Lounge on 89.9, your community, your world, your music.
Welcome back. Well, sea level rise driven by climate change is said to pose an existential crisis to many U.S. coastal communities. New research finds that hundreds of thousands of homes along the coast will face being flooded regularly every other week or so over the next few decades. Now, this new study from the Union of Concerned Scientists warns that our swelling oceans will soak our coastal homes here in Florida and around the world, and losses eventually could tally in the billions. This unless greenhouse gas emissions are sharply curtailed. So what does this look like? Well, picture millions of Americans and millions of us here in Florida living in at-risk properties along the water, seeing their basements, their backyards, their garages, their living rooms inundated with water every other week. With more on this study and its implications for Florida, we welcome Andrea Dutton. She's assistant professor at the University of Florida's Department of Geological Sciences. Professor Dutton heads an international working group investigating future predictions of sea level rise, and she's on the line from Gainesville. Andrea Dutton, a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me today.
And if you have questions about sea level rise in Florida and your property values, give us a call at 549-2937. And so this study used federal data from a high sea level rise scenario that was projected from NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. And they combined that, which is interesting to see, with property data from the real estate company Zillow to look at the list of homeowners. That's an interesting way to go about this. What are your thoughts about the conclusions of this study as a subject matter expert on sea level rise?
So what this report really brought to light, and I think why it grabs a lot of people's attention, is they're really trying to put the dollar amount on how much is at risk in terms of real estate properties, both from residential homes and commercial properties. And as you mentioned, the way they define chronic disruptive flooding, which is what they talk about in this report, is flooding that occurs basically every other week, so about 26 times per year. And they consider that at the point at which it's at risk, and they start to tally up the dollars. Now, some of your listeners might think 26 times a year, you know, that's way above my threshold. I can only handle it once a year or maybe twice a year. And if that's true, then these numbers would only go up, and the point at which the property becomes at risk is actually sooner than that. So part of it is related to that definition. Another thing that you mentioned is that they use a high sea level rise scenario. They actually didn't use the highest one, but they did use a high one because that is the scenario that's appropriate to consider when you're thinking about things that are high risk. And our property, our residential property, is something that we should use a higher end estimate because it's so valuable to us. A lot of people have a lot of their assets tied up in their property, and so that's an appropriate one to be using.
Right. And we're looking at a couple of factors here. Warming oceans. Oceans rising by about 3 millimeters every year due to the water expanding. The ocean is warming because of the burning of fossil fuels. At the same time, glaciers are melting both in Greenland and Antarctica because of warming. Lost ice is also pushing up the sea. And so this scenario, Professor Dutton, is unfolding slowly. As someone who investigates sea level rise, can you tell us a little bit more about the timetable behind what we are looking at and how, you know, the worst case scenario, no reduction in emissions might look, and a better case scenario where the world tries to keep below 2 degrees Celsius warming, how that might look, particularly here in Florida? What's the timetable you see?
Right. So that's a great question. And this report comes on the heels of several studies that were released last week that are looking at exactly what you're talking about, the rate of sea level rise and how it's been actually accelerating. And a lot of those numbers, they sound small, 3 millimeters a year, right? And so people with a beach house might think, hey, I'm good. You know, what's 3 millimeters a year to me? We can already see actually a lot of the impact that 3 millimeters a year has had. But above and beyond that, the observation that we're having about the rate of sea level rise is that it's been accelerating, right? So it used to only be about 1.5 millimeters per year in the last century, and now it's actually closer to 4 millimeters a year. So that number you're using is already outdated because it's been accelerating. And the reason for that acceleration largely comes from the amount of melting that we're seeing both in Greenland and Antarctica. So a long time ago, we thought those ice sheets are so big, it would take so much to perturb them and to melt them that we don't need to worry. But in fact, that's not true. And what we're seeing in the present day and what we also see in the geologic record is that these ice sheets are very sensitive to small changes in temperature. So a new study that was published in Nature last week found that the rate of melting from the Antarctic ice sheet has increased from about only a fraction of a millimeter of a year, has increased threefold since the last time that they looked at it. And so that's cause for concern. And so then the next part of your question is, well, what does this mean for Florida in the future and the sea level rise scenarios? Some of the sea level rise in the future is already baked into the system. We've already warmed the atmosphere, and the ice sheets are still responding to that. So think of it like an ice cube that you throw into a hot room. It's going to take some time for that ice to melt. So basically, when we're looking out to about 2050, which this report looks at, a lot of the numbers are for 2045, about the lifetime of a 30-year mortgage on a house today, that what's going to happen up until about 2050 is already largely baked into the system. Now, what happens beyond that is largely a function of the decisions that we make today about our fossil fuel emissions and curtailing the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And so that should cause people to think, well, there is something to we can do about this, and we can slow this down and make it not as bad. And that's what a lot of the modeling has been showing us.
Right. And let's define not as bad. I'm so interested in speaking with you more about this because I just got back from a week-long fellowship in Rhode Island called the Metcalf Institute for Marine and Environmental Reporting, so that I can better explain this science to our listeners and readers and viewers. Tell us a little bit more about the world we'll see. Let's say what the world comes together on the Paris Climate Accords and actually follows through on pledges to reduce emissions greatly. That's going to be a heavy challenge. The U.S., of course, has pulled out of the Paris Accord. Can we even meet that target? And if, let's assume we meet that target, how will the world look after 2050? I know it's so hard to predict, and there's so much uncertainty associated with science. But paint a picture for us, Professor Dutton, and tell us a little bit more about how you see Florida in this mix. Will there be managed retreat, for example, away from the coasts? Will plummeting real estate values really negatively impact the Florida economy? Tell us more about what you picture as you look across that timeline.
So to start where you started with, is it still possible for us to reach this 2 degrees Celsius target? Yes, it's still theoretically possible, and we can do it, but as you mentioned, it's going to require a lot of social and political will to get there. But it is still technically possible for that to happen. And the difference then that we're looking at in projections at the end of the century, so some of the sea level rise projections we were talking about only a few years ago, we were saying, well, maybe the global average is about 3 feet of sea level rise by the end of the century. And now we're looking at things that are telling us, well, it could be as high as 8 feet, depending on what we do. Now, you mentioned there's a lot of uncertainty in science. In fact, the biggest uncertainty in these projections is not the science, it's what the people do and how the people respond, right? And if we could tell you that, then our model projections would be a lot tighter, because if we knew exactly how the emission scenarios were going to unfold, that would obviously help us to tell you how sea level is going to respond to that as well. And so that's where a lot of that uncertainty comes from. The flip side of the coin, and what I usually talk to people about, is that, in fact, it's not the uncertainty you should focus on. It's the certainty, right? And that, as I mentioned before, we know that sea level is going to continue to rise, even based on the amount of warming that we've already seen. So this is a sure bet. It's not really a risk. There's a quote in this report that we're talking about from Mayor Philip Stoddard from South Miami, where he says, there's no risk, it's a guaranteed total loss. The only uncertainty is the timeline, right, and exactly when that's going to happen. So then the end of your question, you were asking about managed retreat. And what I think is really helpful to envision is to sit down and think about this and say, all right, well, at some point, we are going to lose, for example, most of the Florida Keys, which are very low elevation. We're going to lose a lot of our coastline in Florida. And we can debate about exactly when that's going to happen. But let's put that debate to the side for a moment and think about, how do we want this to unfold, right? Do we want to manage some of that retreat? Because we can make that choice and do it. It's not an easy choice. It's a really hard concept to talk about because it sounds like we're giving up. But in fact, it's not about giving up. It's about accepting the reality and making the losses less in the future, right? And that's where my concern comes from and why I spend a lot of time speaking to the public. I think ultimately what we're talking about here is saving human lives, right? Every extra hour we get before a hurricane comes in about that cone of uncertainty where the hurricane is going to hit, every extra hour of advance notice we have helps to save lives. So here we might have some decades to plan in some places, in some communities, right? But we need to use that time because the changes we have to make, these are not temporary. It's not like a storm surge that's going to come and go. It's going to be here with us to stay. And we're talking about a lot of large, hard infrastructure near the coastlines that we need to deal with in terms of relocating it, or think about retreating or building along what I like to call corridors of retreat, right? That's where we should focus the development, rather than focusing it in the highest risk areas.
And as yet, Florida, to make a bad pun, has its head in the sand about this issue. building continues apace all up and down the coast. And of course, we're not the only state taking this tack. You know, there's no national sea level rise plan for America. And there, and what we're seeing in Florida, Professor Dutton, is only Southeast Florida really tackling this issue head on. The Southeast Florida Regional Climate Compact, a bipartisan coalition of municipalities in South Florida, is trying to aggressively figure out how to deal with this issue. You see them on the phone to the Netherlands all the time, trying to figure out what the Dutch have done to manage water coming in all around them, because they know that that is the future of South Florida. So what about that? What about this cognitive disconnect that we see in Florida about this issue, since we're the state that, frankly, is perhaps the most vulnerable to dealing with the economic fallout of this issue? Shouldn't planning be underway now to deal with what's coming later?
Right. And what really needs to happen is there's not just one solution or one step that we need to take. It needs to be a combination, a mix of things, everything from local to state to federal levels. It's not just top-down, and it's not just bottom-up. It has to work in both directions for it to be effective. And as you mentioned, you know, we're still developing along the coastlines, because what's driving that is the developers who can make their money in a few years and get out. So they're not concerned about the long-term, you know, future of what's going to happen to those properties. But if the communities are concerned, because knowing that that's a high-risk area, they're going to have to bail them out. Are they going to be able to provide, you know, energy and clean water and sewage removal from those sites 30 years in the future? In a lot of cases, the answer is no. And if the communities start to recognize that risk, they can change the zoning laws and make it basically impossible to build in those highest risk areas and say, we're only going to support development in the places where we can foresee being able to sustain those communities into the future, right? And you mentioned that Southeast Florida Climate Compact, and part of what you're starting to see play out here is you have some communities with a lot of money who can pool their resources and do something about it. And there are going to be other communities who might not have the money to address it, who are going to be left behind. So there's going to be an inequality, kind of a social inequality, as we move into the future with how we're able to adapt and respond to climate change and sea level rise. And when you leave it, if it's only at the local level, those inequalities will be stark. And that's one reason why we need some top-down initiatives, like you mentioned, from the federal and the state level, to have some planning, to look at cost-benefit analysis. The state of Louisiana has a program where they've already gone after, in the wake of Hurricane Katrina, and gone to individual communities to say, well, is it worth building a seawall here?
Yeah.
How long would it last? And how much would it cost?
And that's one good real-world example that Florida could look to. And so
exactly.
I hope to have you back on the program again to discuss this, because it's of vital importance to Florida. Andrea Dutton, such a pleasure to have you on the show. She is assistant professor at the University of Florida's Department of Geological Sciences and a noted expert on sea level rise. Professor, thank you so much for being with us.
Absolutely. It was great talking with you.
And in a moment, a Jacksonville legend turns 100 years old this week. We'll speak with Solly Mitchell next.
Community hospice and palliative care. Since 1979, the Compassionate Guide for more than 200,000 patients facing advanced illness in Northeast Florida. Today, serving 16 counties, including yours. Available 24/7 to help you and your loved one. More at choosecommunityhospice.com.
Why is the U.S. still in Afghanistan? A recent ceasefire saw some Taliban fighters and Afghan soldiers hugging and taking selfies. But the latest insurgency has left 70% of the country in the hands of the militants. Hundreds of thousands of Americans have served in Afghanistan. What do they think the U.S. should do now, if anything? Next time on 1A. Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
On the next Fresh Air, our guest will be David Sanger, author of The Perfect Weapon, War, Sabotage, and Fear in the Cyber Age. He writes about the Russian hacking of the DNC, digital sabotage from Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea, and how the U.S. is trying to defend itself. Sanger is a national security correspondent for The New York Times. Join us weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
With the lowest corporate tax rate anywhere, Ireland attracts some of the biggest companies from everywhere.
While Ireland benefits a lot from its tax concessions, other countries lose out a lot, and they're not happy with this.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, a tax avoidance backlash, along with the numbers from Wall Street and the rest of the day's business news, next time on Marketplace.
Weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
I'm David Luckin, host of the Electro Lounge, inviting you to join me Tuesday nights at 9 for Turntable Tuesday, only at the Electro Lounge on 89.9. Your community, your world, your music.
Well, finally this hour, a Jacksonville legend turns 100 years old tomorrow. Solly Mitchell's incredible life story is one everyone needs to know. A Jacksonville native, a veteran, and an activist, Solly graduated from Stanton High School in 1940 and the Florida Normal Class of 1957. He served in World War II and then went to work on the railroad, becoming a member of the famous Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. He was the chair car attendant on the historic Freedom Train for the 1963 March on Washington. Solly was a friend of another local legend, A. Philip Randolph, the Jacksonville man who organized the famous March for Racial Equality, where MLK gave his I Have a Dream speech. Solly is also the oldest and third highest ranking Mason in the state of Florida. In fact, the Solly Mitchell Lodge, number 377, is named in his honor. It's just one of many honors he's received. Now, it's a pleasure on the eve of his 100th birthday to welcome Jacksonville's own Solly Mitchell to Studio 5. Mr. Mitchell, good morning.
Good morning.
And happy birthday one day early.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it very much.
Now, there's a lot of excitement about your birthday. In fact, there's going to be a big celebration at the end of the month. Lots of people coming out to that. But what an incredible life story you have. We're a little short on time. But can I ask you quickly about your memories of going up to D.C. for the March on Washington? Of course, you were a member of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters created by Jacksonville's own A. Philip Randolph.
Right.
Yeah. And you've been asked about this many times, I know, the March on Washington. But that's something that, out of all the things you've experienced, was a highlight, right?
Yes, it was one of the highlights of my life.
One of many. Yes. And so, you know, I think that for folks that reach the age of 100, it's just an incredible thing. And your longevity, your activism, your service to this country have just been extraordinary.
Thank you.
What's your secret?
Well, meet people like you, happy, no worries. Had a good life, met beautiful, nice people, and they have kept me going. I treasure their friendship.
You've got a lot of friends.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you've got friends all over town from what I hear.
Yes, I have quite a few friends. Tony Hill is one of my friends. Lloyd Pearson and I, a good friend. Lloyd Pearson is the brother of Rutledge Pearson.
And civil rights icon.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Right. Well, you are as well. I mean, you were involved in the battle for and the struggle for civil rights.
Right.
Like so many others here in this city.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oscar Taylor was one of my good workers. He was very active. As Charlene Taylor Hill's father, he was very active in the civil rights movement. He also was a city councilman, and he also worked for CXX. He was one of the representatives of
CXX. And you spent decades on the railroad. What was that like? You worked for the railroad.
Yes. I worked for... What happened, I was first hired as a Pullman porter. And when they downsized the porters, then I went over and was able to get a job with the Atlantic Coast Line then. And they had several mergers, you know, after that.
But you spent decades on the railroad.
35 years.
And so the whole city's coming out to celebrate you on June 30th, a big party at the Doubletree on the South Bank. What are your thoughts about that, your 100th birthday?
Well, I just thank them. And I didn't know so many people were thought that much of me.
I think they do. Yeah, they really do. Several people have reached out to me when they heard you were going to be on the radio and express their thanks. So.
Right.
Yeah. It's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Well, I enjoy it very much. I enjoyed Jacksonville. When I came to Jacksonville, I was 13. And attended La Villa High School at that time. It was New La Villa. And I attended that. William Raines was my principal.
Mr. Raines, wow.
And
Stanton, and then on to the railroads and serving in World War II.
Right.
So much that we could keep talking about. Unfortunately, we're almost out of time. But we will have more about Solly's story on our website later today. Solly Mitchell turning 100 tomorrow, and his celebration will be June 30th at the Doubletree on the South Bank at 11:30 a.m. Mr. Mitchell, happy birthday, and thank you for being here.
Thank you so much.
And that's our show.
What a great change since I've been born.
Yes, indeed. That is for sure.
Right.
And thank you. That's our show. Thanks so much for listening. 1A is up next. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. And we'll be back again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. See you then, and have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.